Here's a little black boy from Louisville, Kentucky, sitting in the United Nations, talking to presidents of the world. Why? Because I'm a good boxer. I needed boxing to get here. So my purpose is to use boxing to get to people.
The greatest, the incomparable Muhammad Ali, as you've probably never heard him before, talking to the press in 1979 here at UN headquarters.
It is a great privilege for me to introduce Muhammad Ali, one of the greatest sportsmen, men known around the globe, also poet and a painter. But there is another dimension which Ali will explain. But Ali, before I give you the floor, may I give a chance to President of Correspondent Association to greet you.
Let me just say, Salaam Alaikum and welcome to our midst.
I'm Matt Wells, and you're listening to our podcast classics series from UN News. Later, we'll go more than a few rounds with arguably the most famous sports personality ever, as he delves into diplomacy, religion, his responsibilities as an iconic role model, and painting for peace.
I draw pictures with meanings and to tell stories, and I'm painting now for peace. And tonight, where are we going to be tonight?
At the Roseland.
On West 52nd Street.
It's going to be the largest opening art exhibition.
This will be the largest opening art exhibition for any artist. It will be the greatest of all time.
We have more questions on this.
But first, let's return to today and the upcoming Winter Olympic Games, with the prospects of North and South Korea marching into the stadium side by side in Pyeongchang next month has raised hopes for an eventual resolution of the ongoing nuclear crisis there. Before every Olympics, summer or winter, the UN General Assembly adopts a resolution on building a peaceful and better world through sport. It's known as the Olympic Truce and calls on the world to lay down arms during the Games. After all the bellicose talk of war on the Korean Peninsula over the North's nuclear weapons program, the UN Children's Fund Goodwill Ambassador Yuna Kim's prescient words during the debate over the truce last November have special resonance.
I first experienced the same spirit and power when I was 10-year-old watching the South and North Korean delegations walk into the Olympic Stadium together. I firmly believe the Pyeongchang 2018 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games will help spread the message of peace through one of the few languages that has the power to unite people around the world, the graceful and universal language of sport.
The Olympic skating gold medalist was not alone in highlighting the extraordinary power of sport to help forge peace and break down barriers of mistrust and fear between people. Here's the president of the General Assembly, Miroslav Lajcak, ushering in the 2018 truce for Pyeongchang in South Korea, which, like the rest of the country, has been living in the shadow of rising nuclear tensions for months now.
Once we step out onto a field or court, we are all part of the same system. In this way, sport can be a universal tool which can promote both peace and unity.
The Olympics are run by the International Olympic Committee, which is a partner organization of the UN as a whole. Working within the IOC is the International Olympic Truce Centre, established at the turn of the millennium. The centre is based in the ancient historic home of the whole Olympic movement, the Greek capital Athens. It's fitting for this UN podcast classic that we talk about the classical roots of sport as a vehicle for peace. So we invited the Truce Centre's director, Konstantinos Filis, to take us back to where it all started.
We should go back to 776 BC, where, according to the myth, Iphitos, the king of one of Greece's city-states, which were back then in constant conflict, went to the Delphic oracle and asked how he could end these conflicts. So the oracle urged him to revive the Olympic Games as a means to achieving temporary peace. And every 4 years, a ceasefire was agreed for athletes, spectators, and artists to travel to and from the Games in Olympia. The truce was observed, though not always in full, for some 1,200 years, making it the most durable peace accord in history.
So the entire Olympic movement is based really on this truce principle.
Exactly. And what happened in modern times, in 1993, the UN General Assembly approved a resolution that further solidified UN International Olympic Committee's cooperation with the decision to revive the Olympic truce by adopting the resolution entitled Building a Peaceful and Better World Through Sport and the Olympic Ideal. And as such, in 1994, during the opening ceremony of the Lillehammer Winter Games, and for 24 hours, a ceasefire was achieved in the whole of ex-Yugoslavia. In the 90s, as you may know, there was a continuous conflict in Yugoslavia. After the dissolution of the USSR, Yugoslavia fell apart as well. So there was a ceasefire only for 24 hours, but still, this was a very precious beginning.
So it has had more than just symbolic value in the past, and hopefully will do so in the future.
Hopefully, yes, because in 2000, we had the two Koreas marching together, and the breaking news just reached me, which say that they are going to march together, the two Koreas, and not separately, in the upcoming Pyeongchang Winter Olympic Games, which is, of course, a very encouraging sign. And it is also not only symbolic, but a move that is very substantial.
Konstantinos, you said in your statement following the announcement that North Korea would be sending some kind of a team to the upcoming Winter Olympics that we often underestimate the power of sport to bridge differences, if not to resolve them altogether. What did you mean by that?
Well, Matt, sports do not ultimately bring peace or change the world. But how many people are motivated by sport? How many children in developing countries aspire to be an athlete? And why not an Olympian? What resources are invested in sports development, and what percentage of world GDP comes from the sports industry? In the case of the two Koreas, because of the games, two very important developments took place. The South Korean-US joint military exercises were postponed, and there is an open channel once again after almost 2 years between Seoul and Pyongyang. So the Olympic Games certainly are not going to settle one way or the other the problems between the two sides. But the fact that they de-escalate the tensions, even for a short time, is highly indicative of the power of sports.
So you don't think there's a danger that we can invest perhaps a little too much hope in the transcendent power of sport?
No, given that we know the limits. As I said before, sports cannot on its own make a difference in global politics, and it certainly does not have a political role to play. Sport can serve as a platform for peace. We can also use sport to tackle violent extremism. We can teach communities and children to function according to rules based on sports. We can strengthen the notion of teamwork, learning to work together to achieve a goal. We can also give them the lesson to come to terms with the notion of defeat and therefore seek a second chance.
I was going to say that, of course, the paradox of sport is that there are winners and there are losers.
Okay, that is true. But at the same time, by accepting defeat, given that we play and we accept common rules, which is really important, this is part of the game, as is disagreement with one's opponent, but we will always have a second or a third opportunity to play again, perhaps winning the next time. And to do this, we can devote more of our time to preparation, and training will become our priority. And as we come to realize that there is always another chance available, we are prepared to give our opponents a second chance as well. You know, when we're talking about sport, for instance, in post-conflict societies, on the one hand, there is sports and the risk of losing a game. On the other hand, there is war and the risk of losing your life.
Do you have any wider concerns, Konstantinos, about the huge sums of money that seem to dominate professional sport globally? I mean, we've had some pretty serious corruption scandals recently with which involve the IOC and FIFA, the world governing body for football.
Well, Matt, the sports movement, not only the Olympic movement, but the sports movement as a whole, has been hit by a number of financial scandals, cases of corruption and doping. From the very outset, the International Olympic Committee made it clear through President Thomas Bach that it would not tolerate any such things within its ranks. And it took specific measures to this end, classed on the issue of doping, but also we can say that it fell victim to the politicization of sport. It is crystal clear that all those parties or people involved, irrespective of their status, will punish and have already been punished.
Thanks very much for your time today. We're going to play our listeners very shortly some extraordinary archive audio of Muhammad Ali when he came to the United Nations in the late 1970s. How important are these great sporting international role models to the world, do you think, even if they are, of course, complex figures like Muhammad Ali?
Throughout the 8 years that I am heading the International Olympic Truth Center, we run and we have run a number of educational projects. In every single project where we refer to the youth, we have an Olympian or an athlete acting as a role model. I can tell you that the results are tremendous. An athlete can inspire young people. An athlete can penetrate their minds and their souls. All our ideals, all our values, be it the Olympic values or be it the notion of Olympic truth, can be instilled in the young generation by an athlete acting as a role model in a very, very effective way.
So their contribution really is incalculable. It's priceless.
Their contribution is priceless. And another example which I can share with you is concerning our role models during youth Olympic Games. And I can see the flame in the eyes of the young children who participate in these games whenever they have somebody, an Olympian, being there, sharing his experiences or her experiences. This is really, really priceless. And I can tell you that the culture and education program in the Youth Olympic Games requires the involvement of role models and sportsmen, Olympians as role models. And this gives the opportunity to participate in athletes, to learn about the Olympic values, explore other cultures, and develop the skills to become true ambassadors of sport and peace through the role models. And maybe in the future, they are going to play this role, potential Olympians and sportsmen in their respective countries.
Konstantinos Filis, director of the International Olympic Truth Center, thanks very much indeed. Back now to 1979 and Muhammad Ali, who came to the UN as the reigning and undisputed three-time world heavyweight champion. It wasn't until 1998 that he was appointed a UN Messenger of Peace, but he first came to the UN a year before this historic press conference we're about to hear, when he addressed the UN Special Committee Against Apartheid in South Africa. He was perhaps the most recognisable person on the planet in 1979. His advocacy for the downtrodden of the world and commitment to racial and social justice was forged in the streets of the segregated southern states of the US, together with his refusal to fight in the Vietnam War and conversion to Islam. As an example of the hopes that so many invested in Ali, his first question was about social unrest in Iran against the rule of the then Shah and the possible return to Tehran by the leader of the Iranian Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini.
Would you be prepared to go to Paris and use your influence with Ayatollah Khomeini to bring about some peaceful relationship between the peoples of the troubled land in Iran?
I would be honored to do something of that kind. Ben, you must realize a black man from America, not that educated, became a great boxer, and now talking here at the United Nations and about world sources, and you asking me a question like that is a great honor. So I never thought this would happen to me. I would be in the United Nations. So I would do it only if I could talk with somebody who's authority on those two countries. And would it hurt anybody if I go, would any side use me for something that's not right? And is the general Islamic world behind it, or the United Nations period?
Fighting.
Am I through with fighting? Well, I don't want to say right here I'm through with fighting, because then that would mean I'm retired and the boxing authorities will take my title and vacate it before I retire. I am champion as of this moment, and I'm determined to retire champion. I'm of all the great boxers, majority champions are black. None retired on top. They all retired losers. And it's very important to my people in the world of my kind and all my fans, whoever they are, that I retire champion. And not only that, but retire three-time champion. And the business-wise, commercial-wise, endorsement, movies, traveling, things that I'm doing, my artwork, I'm painting for peace here. To lose a decision or to even fight another fight and look bad would destroy me. So business-wise, the worst thing I can do, it'll be a sin. The worst thing Muhammad Ali could do is to go back in the ring. That's the worst thing I could do. I'm 37, and I'm lucky and thankful to Allah that I still went out on top, defeated all my critics. Oh, man. So for the Islamic world, for the UN, for all that I'm talking about, for peace, for all I want to do, my image is so great. The worst thing I can do is blemish it. If they offer me $50 million tomorrow, I would turn it down because the hearts involved. See, people have heart attacks in the Muslim countries and African countries. They love me so much, even when if I get hurt or if I should want to lose, they'll feel bad. Some countries, they have Malaysia, Philippines, they actually have holidays. In Algeria here, too, people don't go to work on days that I fight to watch television. They take it so serious, it's a spiritual thing. So I'm telling you now, I don't never plan to get the ring in, but I'm still the champion as of now until I announce my retirement, which should take place soon on national network television. We'll have something called the last 15 rounds. We'll show 15 rounds of my best fights, then I'll retire. I want to say another thing. I'm an artist. You all didn't know that I paint. My father's a sign painter. He's a commercial artist. And I draw pictures with meanings and to tell stories. And I'm painting now for peace. And tonight, where are we going to be tonight?
At the Roseland.
Or invite everybody at 9 o'clock at the Roseland. Where's the Roseland located?
On West 52nd Street.
On West 52nd Street.
It's going to be the largest opening art exhibition.
This will be the largest opening art exhibition for any artist. It will be the greatest of all time.
We have more questions on this side.
One of the goals of sports is to promote peace and friendship among nations of the world. And I don't mean to drag you again into politics. As both a Muslim and a peace lover, what is it, in your opinion, that has been making peace in the Middle East so impossible or almost impossible to come by?
There are laws and realities that Allah, God, laid down for man to follow. These laws must be obeyed. There's a law called the law of gravity. You have to fear and respect gravity. What goes up comes down. There's a law that says if a meteorite should get out of orbit, it burns up. You see a flash across the sky. These laws are as fundamental for us to obey as they are the rest of the universe. Man is the only thing in nature that don't obey God's laws. So you suffer. If we were riding on a metro liner from here to Washington, D.C., and we were asleep, and we got up and we started walking like some people walk in their sleep, and we walked over to the door, and we pushed the button, the door open, and we stepped off the train while it was running at 90 miles an hour. Now, you're under delusion. You may think you're at home, but that will not help you when you step out of the train. Although you really think you're at home, and when you fall, and you'll probably kill yourself, even if you still keep your delusion, and the ground and the door of the train will not turn into the door of your house. Now I'm saying something, I'm getting the point. Allah laid down laws, and many of us in the Muslim faith don't follow. We obey man's laws. You're in the United Nations now trying to solve the world's problems. We go to a president to try and solve the world problem. We don't take the whole Quran, the Bible, and say, what did God say on this? We try to solve them. Now, all the reason you don't have no peace in the Middle East, I believe, is because neither side follow the laws of God.
President Carter, up to now, he failed in the bringing peace in the Middle East. How would you like to volunteer and mediate between the Israelis and the Arabs?
I'm not as dumb as I look.
we have now, I think we have...
If I had a lower IQ, I could enjoy that question. No, I was joking. It would be a big honor to try to make peace, but I don't think I can do that. And I don't think President Carter should be called a failure if he tried. No man, because that's a hard job to make a peace and something like that.
Muslim in the high religious man and belief as an artist and writer. I would like to ask you how you compare this with boxing, because religion is against boxing.
Right. Well, I tell you, a good question. Got me on the spot if I couldn't answer you. But I tell you what I say. You look intelligent. That's a good question. That's a, why can I be a fighter when people can get hurt, can get killed, and I'm a religious man. I talk about peace, talk about love, but yet I fight. Okay, Allah knows my purpose. It's not the action that makes the thing right or wrong, but the purpose behind the action. I kill a man today, I kill a man tomorrow. Allah may say, you're right for killing this man, but wrong for killing that one. The judge and the law will say, you're right for this one, wrong. Why am I wrong for killing this man? Because we were arguing over an idea. He made me angry, I was jealous, and I killed him. Why did I kill the next man? Because I got to my house, my children were laying on the floor, throats were cut, my brother was shot, and the man was in the bed raping my wife. And I'm in my excitement, rage, and over my children being dead and my wife being raped, I kill him. I don't get a day in jail, and Allah cannot look at me as a bad man. All right. Both actions is killing, but what's the term? What's the purpose behind it? What is my purpose in boxing? My purpose in boxing is to come to meetings like this. We live in a world, my friend, where if you don't have no money, if you don't have no fame, no title, you're nothing in this society today. In the Arab world, I was over there, I saw people who wait on tables, and the most of them are the blacker people. And I was throughout the world, and I see how our black people are treated in every country. I don't care if he's Arab, Muslim, they talk about unity in all these countries, but I see black people in the mud. I see black people waiting tables, black people are servants, and the whiter ones, the more white they are, the more Americanized they are, the higher they are. This has been established throughout the world. Now, I use boxing because it's a platform. I don't fight a man because I want to hurt him. I pray to Allah every fight, don't let me hurt the man. Jerry Quarry, it's a fact. I hit him, and he was about to fall, and I pulled off, and I told the referee to stop it. Buster Mathis, James Ellis, I had him unconscious on the ropes, and I saw he could have had a hemorrhage, a brain concussion. Allah punished me for deliberately hurting somebody to please the crowd. My intention is not to hurt, not to kill. My intention is to get newspaper published. How would I be? Here's a little black boy from Louisville, Kentucky, sitting in the United Nations, talking to presidents of the world. Why? Because I'm a good boxer. I needed boxing to get here. So my purpose is to use boxing to get to people. My fighting is the why I'm so big. My fighting is why I'm the world's most recognized. All of you people here from your countries, I can take an airplane right now, go to your country, get off and take a walk, and you couldn't control the crowd. I'm the only man in the world can do it because of my boxing. So I'm trying to say boxing was used as a platform to allow the world to know who I am so I can now do the work of God. So God knows I wasn't rid of boxing because I wanted to fight. He knows it wasn't for money. God, Allah, not you. See, you judge my actions, but God judges my heart. See, man judges man's actions, but God judges man's heart. And my heart is to do good and help and love people, preach peace, preach unity, but I got to have a Cadillac. I got to have a Rolls Royce. I got to have a home in Hollywood because they don't listen to you in this country if you're nobody.
Last two questions, sir.
So that's why I box. That's why I box. So on those bases, God will not punish me because he knows what I'm saying now is true. All boxers are quiet and humble. I start talking. I am the greatest. I am the prettiest. This makes people angry. They come and see me win and lose, and one thing led to another. And so I went to Brezhnev the other day, and I was over in Russia, and they said, Brezhnev want to see you. Antonio Dobrynin, UN, told me, ambassador in Washington, Antonio Dobrynin to Russia. He said, every little boy, every little girl, everybody in Russia know Muhammad Ali. Old people, wherever you go, no American, they know nobody but Muhammad Ali. No World Series, no Kentucky Derby, no Indianapolis 500, no Super Bowl. They only know Muhammad Ali. In all of your countries, whether from Pakistan, Morocco, Arabia, India, they seen. I said, I can't just go fishing or I can't just make movies. I got to do something. I went to Mr. Shabazz back there. We're in Seoul, Korea. We went to Seoul, Korea. We had 2 million people in the streets of Korea. We went to Hore Bomedian's funeral. President Carter's aide, Andy Young, called me and says, Ali, Muslims, only Muslims can go to a certain prayer service. We think you, almost American, can go in. I flew over there with Chip Carter and Blumenthal and Secretary Chair, and all of this stuff, and I'm sitting up here with MIV in the UN. I'm just a boxer. And the mayor of New York welcomed me, and people all on the streets looking. I said, what now? God's calling me for something. What am I going to do? I just can't just do nothing. So I sent him in. I said, I'm going to start me an organization called WORLD. It's WORLD, stand for World Organization for Rights, Living, Dignity. 5 letters. Each letter be black, brown, red, yellow, and white, representing all nations. And we'll do all we can to make peace between nations on a social level. No politics involved, no race involved, no religion involved, just all people trying to better.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, Muhammad Ali would like to show you a poster given to him by the Secretary General, who called him today Ambassador of Peace.
Muhammad Ali's picture will hang in the building.
That I will tell you tomorrow at the briefing. I have to keep something for the briefing tomorrow.
The greatest, Muhammad Ali, keeping the foreign correspondents here spellbound while he beguiled, amazed, entertained, and above all, stood up for the idea of a united world of equal rights, peace, and social justice for all. He died in 2016, aged 74, after a long battle with Parkinson's disease, a nervous system disorder which his doctors linked to the thousands of punches he'd taken in the ring. I'm Matt Wells, and you've been listening to our UN News podcast classic series, which features the best of the unique audiovisual archive that we treasure here at UN headquarters. You can take a look around the site yourself by going to www.unmultimedia.org/AV Library/. If you want to sample the full range of historic audio, go to unmultimedia.org/classics. Thanks very much for taking the time to listen.